going to ask our panelists to come up. You've seen the pictures, the black and white pictures. Now you'll see the real people. Dr. Ike Padnos, he's a real MD, but he's also passionate about the music of New Orleans, and through the Ponderosa Stomp Foundation has brought that music, and it's, come on up. Where's Dr. Ike? Come on right up. No, this is going to be talking. Excuse me.
Can you bring who you have in?
Sure. Had to have the battery changed in my watch yesterday, and as I was leaving the shop, the man said, by the way, it's on New Orleans time now. And some of our panelists are on their way now, apparently. however, some are also here. So Dr. Ike Padnos will be here in a moment and bring out the panelists that he has. The Ponderosa Stomp Foundation, if you're not familiar with it, has been quite active for the last few years. Dr. Ike is a prime mover of that organization. They are staging an exhibit currently, which is open to ARSC members over at the Cabildo. And part of our reception over there will be a tour of that exhibit, much of which is based on Dr. Ike's own collection and materials that he has. And also has access to. In addition, they put on live performances, and I believe last month was one of the major performance sessions and staged by the Ponderosa Stomp Foundation. So it's an excellent organization to support if you're interested in this kind of music. So I'm now waiting for Dr. Ike, who went back out.
This morning. My name is Ira Padnos. I'm from the Ponderosa Stomp Foundation. I'm going to be moderating. Unfortunately, New Orleans time, most people, when you tell them at 9 o'clock, they seem to think in nighttime, so part of our panel is on its way. Please excuse it. But we're, you know, it's priceless that we get this opportunity to have these gentlemen join us. On my far right, we have Mr. Harold Batiste. For those of you that don't know this gentleman's accomplishments, Mr. Batiste started off as a jazz musician. He went out to L.A. and was playing gigs with Ornette Coleman. He then hooked up with Keen Records and produced Sam Cooke's You Send Me. From there, he was signed by Art Roop to be the New Orleans A&R man, came back to New Orleans, supervised countless sessions, including Art Neville's Chidooky Doo, among others. He then was noticing that the musicians, many of the session musicians, weren't reaping the benefits or financial gains of their work and started All for One, or AFO, which was the first black musician-owned label probably in the country. Unfortunately, despite their attempts to, in their business model, it seems that they were undone by their distributor, Juggy Murray. He then went back to AFO, was working for Sam Cooke, doing stuff for Sar Records, did a lot of session work, did stuff with Phil Spector, helped mastermind the Dr. John's Grigri record, among others. Spent many years in L.A. and then moved back to New Orleans to spearhead the University of New Orleans Jazz Studies program. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Harold Batiste. Next to him, we have Mr. Wardell Kazir, nicknamed the Creole Beethoven by Alan Toussaint. Wardell started his first arrangements that came to note were on Dave Bartholomew's New Orleans House Party album. He also had worked some with Bernadine Washington on the Imperial sides. He then worked with practically everybody in New Orleans through the years doing arrangements, and many of his better-known hits that you will be familiar with is the Dixie Cups, Ico, Ico, and Chapel of Love, done for Redbird Records. He also had Barefooting by Robert Parker for NOLA. Another great song was Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye, Danny White, recorded for Frisco Records. In addition to that, there's the great work he did with the legendary session at Malco Studios with Gene Knight and King Floyd producing Groove Me and Mr. Big Stuff. He later worked with Paul Simon, Aaron Neville, and countless others. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Mr. Wardell Cazare.
Thank you very much.
Okay, so we're going to start. And grounding this, since this is kind of a recorded, your specialty is recorded music, I thought we'd start out by talking about what your first experiences, both of you, was when you first encountered the Cosmo Matassa studio in New Orleans. What was it like when your very first time walking in there?
Oh, wow. When was the first time I went in the Cosmo? Oh, man. That was a long time ago. No, it wasn't Joe Jones. Let me see. Because the first big hit that I got was a song called You Talk Too Much. Y'all might not be old enough to even remember that. Oh, yes. Y'all older than me then. Yeah, well, that was in Joe Ruffino's studio. He had a studio above what All South Distributors on Baron Street, and we did a session, you know, that you talked too much up there. But I'm trying to remember when the first time I went in Cosmo studio. You know, Marvel was with the American Jazz Quintet, because that's when we did our first jazz record there, back in, what it was, 1961 or something like that. But Cosmo was always a sort of a hero of mine. Two guys were my childhood heroes, was Cosmo Matassa and Dave Bartholomew. You ever heard of Dave Bartholomew? Y'all know Dave Bartholomew. And it was funny, the reason why I idolized those two guys, because I noticed they didn't smoke. Neither one of them smoked. And I was real odd in those days to see somebody that didn't smoke. Because, I mean, anyway, but that's when I first went.
So, Wardell, you pretty much, I believe that your first session, one of your first sessions, was doing the New Orleans House Party record with Dave Bartholomew and working with Dave Bartholomew's great band. What was that like?
Very nice, man. First of all, when I met Kaz, he's a very nice man and very calm. You know, I remember doing a session with barefooting with him, and we was rehearsing, getting the tune ready, blum, 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 blum. We finally camped to what I really liked, and so we rehearsed it for the last time. So we did it, and, man, it had a groove on that, unreasonable groove. And I told Kaz, play back. He said, play what back? He said, you didn't tell me you were recording. I said, and I tell you what, it took me at least another half an hour to get that Sam feeling to barefooting. But that was one of the first encounters I met him. Of course, we did the session with Dave, House Party. And that was, they had some great musicians on that. I did another big band thing with Professor Lawn here. And I tell you what, it was another studio, not the main one that he had before. And if you ever seen a pack of sardines, you should have been in that rehearsal, in that recording session. I think the only thing was lacking was the olive oil in the can. It was that tight. But we did it, man, and I remember that it had so many different things. The drummer was Smokey Johnson. He pounded the drum so hard that he had He had blood coming from his thumb to the forefinger in between that section there. And he had to tape his finger. He was hitting the drum so hard. I was wondering why. He must have some kind of tough bowskin on the drums, because he really pounded hard on that. The singer, we had to tie Professor Longhead, his legs to the leg of the piano, because when he sings, he keeps the tempo with his leg, you know. And really, he don't need a drummer, but but he did have one that day, and that was Smokey Johnson. And we had to tie his arm to his back, because he was playing this thing with the left hand only. So we had to tie his right hand to the to his back. And because you see, at that time, the only thing I was notified when I came up was, you know, I wasn't no pioneer or anything like that. I just followed the trend of what was going on, but into a larger aspect, you know, like the use of the horns and sessions and all of that. That time, before my time, like in Harold's time, you know, that was before my time. and what I mean by that, I'm not talking about age. I'm talking about recording, you know, recording time. So I know you're older than me, but I mean, I won't say it to the public, though.
This is not the public.
So anyway, his name made me lose my throat, Arrow. But anyway, at the session, I had my brother that played. What he did, he got some broomsticks and some Coca-Cola tops, and he cleared all of the cork out of the top and nailed everything to the broomstick and made it sound like a big tambourine or something like that, you know. So that was on the session. We had good horn players. The thing, like I said, we was in a small studio, so but it really worked out good. It was nice working with the guys. But that was one of my first things with Dave and the thing with Professor Longhead. And I think I graduated to some of the other stuff with the Dixie Cups. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Harold, can you talk a little bit about one of the early, the first session you did with All for One on one of the early ones, your first hit-making session with Prince Lala and Barbara George?
Okay, I can talk about that, but at first, I'd like to see. I don't know who these people are. I don't know who I'm talking to. You know, they know who we are, but we don't know nothing about them.
These are scholars, Harold, from American side, and recording people. and they're all they're here for the American Society of Recording. American.
See, you don't know either.
No, I know who they are. I'm sorry, but I forget the things. But they're here. They're here to learn about you, and they're interested.
Okay. All right. But yeah, I was really amazed to come down here and see, you know, all of you people here. And this is a hard morning. Ira knows that. Well, I told him anyway that I had to do. I had to get up at 5 o'clock this morning and do a television show that was at 5:15. And it was, and then this cat come to get me talking about do another panel, which I thought was at night. I thought it was 9 o'clock at night. So here we are again. Now, what you say you want me to talk about?
Can you talk a little bit about your first the Barbara George and Prince?
Oh, that was the first thing that. And after I decided to try to start a record label, and really, it was more important to me why we started that label, because I noticed that this was a city that was producing a lot of music, and I came up in a black community. It was still segregated then, And I know that most of the stuff that I was familiar with were things coming out of the black community. And I noticed that there was no return in the black community economically, because there was no black record companies. They were all owned by white people. And so it was almost accepted that cats like, you know, Eddie Bowen, Thomas Shelvin, and all those cats like that would run there to do their records. And I didn't know then that was the independent labels had already started doing that. Is John Brovin here?
Yes, he is.
He's here? Oh, there he is. There. See, John Brovin wrote a book called Record Breakers and Record Makers or something like that. If I had had a book like that when I started off, I never would even try to get in the record business. No, man, boy. Man, when I realized how all those cats were doing the same thing that was happening here, they had been doing that in all those other little cities, you know, where they found out that they had music in the black community. And anyway, that's why AFO was just started like that. All for One was an attempt to try to return some of the economic value of the kind of music we did back into some of the hands of people in our community. But, you know, this, and I hate to say this, y'all, there's a lot of white people in here. But this is the history of our country has not really change for our people, not much. There's a lot of progress has been made, but there's still a lot of remnants of slavery. And not real slavery, but economic slavery. You know, where the all of the money goes one way, and what's left over, and the least of what is left over stays in the black community. And it causes a lot of other problems that we have now that are really needed. It causes a lot of crime. It causes a lot of what we call crime, but it's just people trying to survive. Don't get me started. Okay. What you asked me about? What you asked me about? Oh, Barbara George. Jesse Hill, you ever heard Jesse Hill was a cat that had a record called Oopa Wadoo? He was signed to Minute Records, was it?
Yes.
Minute Records, yeah. But when I started AFO, he wanted to sign up with AFO, but he couldn't. He was already under contract. But he was already a big hit, and he had groupies. One of his groupies was Barbara George, you know, and so he brought her to us. He brought her to us to see if we would record her, and accompanying her on guitar so she could audition was a cat named Lawrence Nelson, Barbara was supposed to do a song called He Put the Hurt on Me. But she was having a problem with the rhythm. So this boy, Lawrence, decided to sing it to her to show her how to get it. But when we heard him sing it, we said, man, we can record this cat. So we recorded a split session that day. We recorded both... We didn't call him Lawrence Nelson. We called him Prince Lala. And then we recorded Barbara George. And she had a little song that she had written, a little simple song called I Know You Don't Love Me No More. And I think what made that hit record was two things. She said, I don't want to be hurted anymore. And that word hurted just stood out. And then we had a cornet solo on the record, which was different in those days to have a cornet solo on a record. And that, those were our first two records that we put out, and Prince Lala's record was a regional hit. And Barbara George's went all the way, I think, to number three in the country. So that launched our record label, you know. I mean, it was unheard of for, you know, something like that to happen so quickly. And it surprised all of us, too. But it thrilled us. When the first day I heard those cats at the radio station put our record on the radio, and I realized all the people are hearing that now. Everybody's hearing our record on the radio. It was a real thrill to hear that. So that's what Barbara George, you know.
And can you discuss a little bit about how the financial gains did not come back to you?
No, because I didn't know what I was doing. Like I said, John Drummond wrote his book too late. I didn't know what I was doing, so I didn't understand, you know, how it really worked. And the cat who came down, Juggy Murray, who actually was looking for an A&R man for his record label in New York, Suit Records. I think, yeah, that was it. And he was out in California looking for somebody to come up there and be his A&R man. He ran into a cat I knew out there named Sonny Bono. Yeah, and Sonny said, well, look, there's a cat in New Orleans. Maybe he would, you know, want to work for y'all to do that. So Juggy Murray called on there to tell me, what, you know, he wanted somebody to do that. But I said, no, man, we just started a record label down here. That was before we put anything out. And he said, you signed up with anybody down there? I said, no, we ain't signed up with nothing. He said, well, don't sign with nobody. I'm coming. And he left Los Angeles and came to New Orleans. And none of us knew who he was, but he said he was coming down here. Don't sign nothing with nobody. We're going to do this and do that. And we went out to the airport to meet him, but we didn't know who he was. We didn't know whether he was black or white. And he realized when he saw us out there that we was looking for somebody. And then we found out he was black. And that sort of relieved us, see, because that was our big problem. We said, how can we get national distribution for our record? Because there ain't no black distributors, I didn't think. But he had a record label, and we didn't know nothing about, you know, getting another record label to do your stuff. But that's what he brought to us, that he had a record label there, but he would sign us up as a something, and he would distribute our record all over the country and distribute on our label. So we signed up something with him. And just so happy, because he not. And in the meantime, the trick was, in the meantime, there was another black-owned record company in New York, a guy named,
Bobby Robinson?
Bobby Robinson, yeah, Bobby Robinson. He had a little record, and he had met a cat that was working for him named Marshall Seahorn. Y'all know Marshall Seahorn? Huh? That's what you call him?
No.
My partner, Melvin Lancy, who was my partner, used to call him Caveman. Alan Toussaint here. I mean, because I had done a record on this cat before. When Alan Toussaint was playing piano for him, his name is Lee Dorsey. He had, and I had done a record on Lee Dorsey called Lottie Moe or something like that. But Alan Toussaint was supposed to record Lee Dorsey for Minute Records or somebody. Alan whatever was a complication, Alan couldn't be with us. Alan wanted to be with the AFO, but he couldn't do that either because he was under contract a minute. So Alan asked me, could I do this session on Lee Dorsey for him? So I got to do that too. So Yaya, he asked me to do Yaya and whatever else. I had three or four sides to do doing him. So I had to do Yaya. So that came out, and it came out on Bobby Robinson label before we put out Barbara George's record. So his record went up to the charts before I Know Went Up. And Juggy Murray sort of got, I started to say pissed off, but I can't say that. Juggy Murray got upset because, you know, see, why y'all didn't give me that, you know? And we didn't think in terms of that kind of competition before. I said, because we got a lot of people down here. We can make records like this for a lot of y'all. Everybody can get one of these. And so that's what I think upset Juggy Murray, with us anyway, you know. So he got his revenge, though, very good, quickly, you know, because, you know, he eventually he convinced Barbara. Once Melvin and I put Barbara on the road, and we started getting him shows and stuff like that. She did the Regal Theater in Chicago, and then she did the Howard, I think it is, in Washington. And next she was going to do the Apollo in New York. So it was Melvin and I said, well, when she gets to New York, Juggy can take over for, you know, because we had brought her out on the road, and then we could come back home and let Juggy handle it. Man, this cat got poor Barbara in New York. Bought her a Cadillac and a fur coat. Nah, y'all didn't laugh, but that's laughable. That's, you know, I mean, it's just, you know, it really shocked me that he would do something like that. He got that young, she was only 19 years old. And she didn't understand it, that he was taking her money and giving her a Cadillac, made her think he was giving her a Cadillac. That's the, who's that guy who did Cadillac, that movie Cadillac Records or something? Y'all don't know who it was? Huh? Chet, Leonard Chet. So I said, that's where that came from, Cadillac man. So Juggy was in that business. He bought her a Cadillac and bought her a fur coat. And told her that she needs to buy her contract from us. And she went for it. And we didn't know what was going on in New York until Barbara's mother called. They were still living in the project down in New Orleans. And her mama called and said, Barbara wants to buy her contract. I said, you got that wrong. I know she don't want to buy a contract from us. But Melvin and I decided, man, we better go up there to New York and find out what's going on. And so we went to New York. And we found out that not only had he done that, but guys that we talked to in the business says, you know, I think they're going together or something like that, you know what I mean? And so, I mean, he had seduced this little girl, this young lady, and he gave her those trinkets like that. So she I said, Juggy, you shouldn't do that, man. First of all, you don't know how to record this girl. You don't know what you do. You know, you can't do it. Oh, I got cats in New York and do that, you know. I said, well, all right, you got it. And it was a joke. It was a joke because I knew some cats in New York who played on a record. They had Barbara in a studio, and the cats say, Juggy got in an argument with the musicians, and they
and Bob was going to sleep. it was a bad situation up there, man. But I knew he didn't understand how to deal with this legitimately. So that was the last, you know. We got to do an album on Barbara, but you know she was gone. And,
So, Wardell, speaking of New York sessions, can you talk a little bit about how you had gone up to New York and how the whole Dixie Cup session came up with Joe Jones orchestrating that one?
Oh, God. Joe Jones. He did this record with Harold called You Talk Too Much. I think you did that, Harold. Mm-hmm. You Talk Too Much. And, man, he was a guy. He gets on elevators. I don't care who's on it. You can be the president of the United States. He's always passing out a card. I'm Joe Jones, and I did You Talk Too Much. You Talk Too Much. You Talk Too Much. You're talking to everybody looking at each other. Who the heck is You Talk Too Much? I said, well, that's Joe Jones. Well, anyway, he finally hooked up with me in New Orleans. He said, what the hell, I have a group, sisters, was two sisters and another young lady, and they call themselves the Dixie Cups, and I want you to rehearse them because I want to record them. So first of all, the only thing I knew about Joe Jones that he did that record, You Talk Too Much, and he really talked me into doing it. So I started rehearsing the group like that, and he lived about a block or two from me when I was on New Orleans Street, and he was one of those kind of cats, man. You talk too much. And now he really talked too much because he gets himself into a whole lot of good things, man. But he talks himself out of it. He didn't know when to stop talking. So he should have made a record. I better stop talking. I talk too much. I better stop. So I rehearsed the group and things like that. So he said, man, you are there, I think I'm going to go to New York and record them. And at that time, man, we went up to New York with a good artist called Shine Robinson, Al Shine Robinson, and Earl King. We came up there, Earl King, Al Robinson, me, who the heck else was that? The piano player, what's that with the big fingers, man? Escarita. We went with Escarita too. And Escarita and Earl King almost got into a big fight over there. Well, I ain't going to say what the song was that they was fighting about. Because like Harold, I don't want to repeat nothing in front of the ladies. Because if you clear your ears, I mean, if you close your ears, I'll tell the men what he said. But anyway... So I'm rehearsing. We finally got, and the Dixie Cups was a group of two sisters and another young lady, and they really had good ears, you know. So the only thing I did with them is to perfect some of the songs that we went up to New York to sing. But they had natural ability as far as hearing their harmony and things like that. All I had to do was just perfect it in a sense, you know what I mean? So we finally go to New York. Was it New York? It was New York. We go there, man, and had studio time for another group at one of the studios. And what Joe did, he went up to that place and he told the studio, okay, I'm here with a session for Lieben Stoller. Somewhere we start packing, we start unpacking, start playing our music and things like that, and Lieben Stoller come walking in there. He said, man, I thought we had the studio time. And the guy said, well, this is your musicians and all. He said, well, who is that? He said, a guy named You Talk Too Much, Joe Jones. So Joe Jones, they finally went and said, hey, man, what's going on? This is my studio time. And Joe Jones talked his way into letting these people hear the Dixie Cups. And from the Dixie Cups, they had this young lady that they wrote. She wrote the. Oh man. No, someone from the audience. I think Joe Jones and Dixie Cuff, they're going to the chapel. She wrote the song, and left the Dixie Cuff. We rehearsed that, and we recorded it. Now, Joe Jones said, now, look, Waddell, I can't pay you anything. Now, this is way back in the game now when I saw practice, and he said, but if I do anything, I will hire you to go, to come with me. Okay, I said, fine, man. So I was doing all this for nothing, like nobody knows what money is as far as recording, because you love the work and the music so much, the money came later, you know, it's in my mind anyway. So, man, we rehearsed, and then finally the song come out and it hits. So the song comes out and hits, and I say, okay, Joe, when we going out? Is he going out where, man? I said, when I'm gonna go out so I can start preparing? He said, well, I got somebody else to do the work. I said, why? He said, because I thought, man, you know, you're a home man, and I didn't think that you would like to go to New York to work and all that. I said, well, man, why didn't you ask me? So that was another one of my experiences with musicians that, man, if you don't put it on paper, forget it. So that was my experience with that. And everything I came out with musicians, man, it's always the troublemakers some way, you know? But I have a whole lot of stories to tell, man, about they should have called me the middleman in a whole lot of things, because I remember I was working for the union as the secretary of the union. So they sent me to oversee a session that someone was doing. So I go to the studio, and I'm overseeing, man, and hear one of the artists and one of the background singers is arguing why he had a hit. So I'm just listening. I say, man, when is this going to start and all things like that? Man, I do. The background singer said, if it wasn't for me, it wouldn't have been a hit. And then the recording artist said, man, if it wasn't for me, we wouldn't have cut the song. And they start fighting, the artist picked up a 2x4 and was ready to hit him in the head, and I was in the middle of it. And I put my hand up in the air, and it hit my arm, but it was a glance, you don't understand. So I said, man, and another thing happened to Sam. We're the same thing, man, 2x4. When I go to studios, I be sure there's no 2x4 handy, so I won't get in the middle of it and things like that. But artists is something else, man. You either love them or leave them. So.
Well, we have the rest of our panel, and this is really a great honor to have. Next to Waddell, we have Bob French, who was taught by Louis Farbrand, the great drummer. And he, in addition to doing countless New Orleans sessions on drums, including stuff on Fats Domino and Earl King, he also leads the Tuxedo Jazz Band. He started with his father and led it. This is Mr. Bob French. And we're very, very proud to the gentleman on the left. Many people can make claim that they started something. This is the man that probably put the backbeat in rock and roll and helped create it. Without this man producing, arranging, putting together the bands, and basically signing and doing all the leading the sessions and producing, Fats Domino and countless artists wouldn't exist. This is Mr. Dave Bartholomew.
The past him. I worked out of Hollywood, 6425 Hollywood Boulevard, for 25, 30 years, for Lou Chet. I said to say this. Always have admired Mr. Let me see him. What the heck is that? We all call him Mr. Quizzy Q. By saying Quizzy Q, he really never got a break. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Mr. White Elk is there. And the one next to him on the end, Sonny and Cher. Sonny and Cher. They never got that just do is what I'm trying to say. Gentlemen, it's nice to see you guys. Mr. Baptiste, instrumental in being there a long time. And I was fortunate enough to make some records with different labels. I can sit down now. When you get to be 89 years old, that's what I am, you got to sit down sometime.
Dave, can
now that I got everybody's attention, where's my money?
Dave,
he knew that was coming.
Dave, can you talk a little bit about the first time you ever went into Cosmos Studio and how you recorded for Deluxe, how that came to be?
Ladies and gents, I would like to say this too first. Dr. Ira, a wonderful friend, has been around me for the last 40 years, and I want you to know that he's a great, great man, always looking out for the New Orleans musician. Thank you, Dr. Ira. Before I forget... I will answer some questions that he will ask, and if I don't like them, I won't answer. No, okay, go ahead on.
All right, can you talk a little bit about the first time you went to Cosmos Studio and recorded what first session you did for Deluxe?
The first time I went to Cosmos Studio, I would say Mr. Cosmos was attached to you. Happened to be the best friend I've ever had in my life. Got out of the Army. And some people told me, said there's a recording studio down on Rampart Street. So I went down there, and I saw Mr. Matassa, and he said, Dave, thus and so, I put my band together. In 1947, I got out of the Army, and I started my band. I was in 196 AGF band, that's the Army band, for 4 years, all over Europe, different places, and happened to be with some great, great musicians. Great people. And I learned an awful lot from these different people. Great musicians, and a lot of guys were in the Army that were very instrumental in being education. I say that to say this. So one Saturday, I had a date to go to the USO and see this girl, this special girl I'd been talking to. You guys know what I'm talking about. Oh, at last I got up. She said, yeah, well, I want to talk to you, you know. So what actually happened, a guy by the name of Mr. Abraham Malone was our piano player in the 196 AGF band. That's the Army band. And he told me, say, here is a chart. This is for you to learn how to write. You can play. He said, but you don't know how to write. I said, you're right. Took that chart. I said, look, man, just let me slide. This is Saturday. I want to go to town and have some fun. He said, you get this, you can have a lot of fun once you learn how to write and do something. So sure enough, I started putting down different things in the Army band. Quite natural. You could try them out because it was far that I was in that band, the military band, and we broke down the orchestra out of that. So sure enough, that's the way it started. Different little things, and I worried him to death. He said, no, you got the 7 chord on the bottom, and they ain't supposed to be there. What is the tonic of the tone? What you want to sell is the melody first. Get somebody to sing what you're doing, then you got them going. He said, what are you doing to make it so simple? Make it real simple so they can understand just what, you know, where you're coming from. So sure enough, I started doing that. With the band in 1947, Bob, I wrote some little ditties. I didn't know they were, you know, anything of no value, but the people started coming around. Working at the Greystone. I walked in the Greystone, the man, I said, I want I want you to play it with all of you. Guess what I say? You're going to give me $12 a night. Because the scale was about $5 to $6 a night. He said, I'm not going to give you no $12 a night. He said, I'm going to give your fellas $18 a night. I said, what? He said, 18. I said, why you say that? $18 per man. Mr. Clarence Hall had played with a lot of older bands, Papa Celestine, Joe Robichaud, name it. I played with all the guys when I was 15 years old. I was playing for his trumpet with Mo. In Baton Rouge, Louisiana, I was playing with the band. So also Claiborne Williams in Donaldsonville, Louisiana. So I played with all them old musicians when I was 15 years old. I could read. And during those times, you had to be a first trumpet player to play in all those bands. So that meant I was kind of busy on weekends, catch the bus out of New Orleans and go to Donaldsonville, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Gonzales, places like that, and play with these different bands. Claiborne Williams and another band out of Baton Rouge. I can't think of the name at the present time. But that's how I got started. And these people saw that around me. So I learned to start getting off. But then getting back to the Army, the first thing I put out at the Greystone. Went in the Greystone. Oh, what is this? Packed in jam. You're doing something, Alamu. Sure enough, that was a stepping stone. Everybody all over New Orleans, Louisiana, coming in to hear me play. Next thing I know, the late Don Robey, Houston, Texas, had me come to his place. That's when everything started looking up. Big money. So he said, I'd like to have you for about 3 or 4 weeks. I said, oh, yes, indeed. No more grits and grease for breakfast and shredded milk, no, like ham. Sure enough, that's where musicians talk to each other. We never look back. All the little ditties and things are like that. So what actually happened, but we were working and playing different places, doing all right. So I go to Cosmo, he said, anything that you want to do, just have your auditions here. Here's the big thing. Get back from Houston, Texas. Here's a guy by the name of Antoine Fats Domino, breaking up the place in the Ninth Ward. So what is this? I walked in there, couldn't get in the door. And he and I got together. We had 19 million sellers in a row, with the help of Mr. Cosmo Matassa and great, great musicians from the Papa Celestine band, different other bands that was in New Orleans, Louisiana at that time. So it wasn't all me. I was here with Thus and So and So. And I had the greatest drummer in the world, musical genius, the late Earl Palmer. I had, everybody said Bartholomew, but I had an awful lot of help. And we never looked back. Remember Mr. Matassa, I said, look, we're going there like 10 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock at night, we're still there. And Mr. Cosmos never said, when I'm tired, that's and so and so. So I had an awful lot of people to thank. Ladies and gents, Mr. Cosmo Matassa, a great, great man, and all these musicians up here, they didn't get the just do like I got it. Mr. Baptiste on the end, he got some, but Mr. Wardell is out, and all he had was pat on the back. Mr. Wardell Gazan, I want to thank you. His last two I made in Europe about 15, 20 years ago. Mr. Wardell Gazan started with me in Paris on piano. Every day on his intermission, guess what he got at night? Some more music for us to play. So went all over Paris, went to Riviera, stayed at the Riviera. I think that's the last time he played in my band. In other words, every time I turned around, he had a rehearsal going on. Not to change things from Cosmo Matassa, I just want to show I had everybody helping me. Some people say I didn't do it by myself, so I had an awful lot of great help from everybody. I should say it with all my success. What I want to do, I don't want to just leave anybody out. Thank you very much.
Thank
I might add that some people ask me, why didn't you get your own publishing company? That's another one. To be frank with you, when we first started, I was so interested in trying to get a hit out there, I forgot all about the publishing because at the door we were making money. Not a lot of big money, but strong money. But when I finally got information about the publishing, the rappers woke me up. Rap music. I said, that will never sell. And I've been so damn wrong. And these guys were smarter than Fats and I at that time. So I said to Fats, let's try to get our own publishing. I said, we will go to the big boss and tell him we're not doing anything anymore. We want part of the publishing. We have a great catalog out there, but we don't own any of the publishing. So I get what's left. And that is the truth. I take a Bible on that. Thank you.
All right. Record breaking, record breaking.
Well, see, let me tell you something about Dave, man. All what he's saying is true, but you have to remember this, man. He is the pioneer of rock and roll. He is the pioneer of everyone in New Orleans to make us realize that we can do something on our own, or at least get out there and try on our own. He led the way to it. And regardless of that, I appreciate you saying what you had to say about me like that, Dave, but it was for you that I owe my career in the recording business. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kazan.
It seems that I came along a little later, but I say the same thing, Dave. I used to sit on my porch. When you used to record, you used to rehearse at the Dewdrop, and I lived right across the street in the project. And I used to stand on my, I said, man, that's different time you were playing. And I could hear loud trumpet over there. And you had the
my theme song.
And I said, man, that's Dave Bartholomew. And I think I told these people, right. I had two heroes, Dave Bartholomew and Cosmo Mutasa. And I like both of them because they didn't smoke.
Never did. Never did. And I'd also like to say this to Mr. Alan Toussaint. Most of you here know about the storm, Katrina. And we left here in a hurry. Didn't know where we were going, things like that. But I was gone, my wife and I and my family, to Texas. We live in Dallas, Texas, for the last 4 years. And completely out of music I was, because I was worrying about different things. I lost 3 of my musicians since that. I'm talking about that wise, you know. And the main thing about being away and get a chance to see what was actually happening to the New Orleans music. Come back here now, and everything is kind of new to me, because you're having an influx of a lot of new people from all over different places coming here to see what's happening with the rebuilding, I would say, of New Orleans. And some are actually staying. And identity that we had many, many years ago, we got about 15 different little bands. And I don't mean to say different little bands, but different bands, I would say, in New Orleans at the present time. And it's not, we have to keep in mind that the big beat started the second line band. That's the way I feel. That's where I got it from. But right now, some of the things I see in New Orleans is actually trying to change us. I never forget Mr. Louis Dumain, who used to have I forget the name, of Eureka Band. And they started with the big beat second line band, but the music was organized, put together, I believe, in organization. harmony for two or three homes, not just everybody taking doing what they want to do. But I find right now that it's actually changing. And I think that what we need is some of the authentic music that we did many, many, many years ago. I'm talking about what we call Dixieland, traditional music. We've lost some of that. So number one, I don't hear anymore with Mr. Batista Kleinert, Mr. Wardell. I don't see that anymore. You know, like, you know, let's say high society. You know what I'm talking about. I don't hear nobody playing that. They're going around that. The beginning of Stardust, you know, you know what I mean, that type of thing. I don't hear that. All I hear is somebody, well, I got everybody in New Orleans the band leader now. I got that. I'm not jealous now. I just don't like it. You know. But but it's changed. You know, you don't see that anymore. But like me, most people say, well, when I play Stardust, I always play the introduction. You know. Well, one secret I found out, because it's D flat, most of these B flat trumpet players can't play one of them kind of things. You know? But nevertheless, for that, I want to thank Mr. Wardell Cazare, if I forget, Mr. Bob French. Bob is also on a lot of, Fast Domino tunes with me, too. But he used to hold my hand. Look, you got a session going on. I don't have no money. Hold it up, you understand? Bob French, yeah.
Begging.
Why don't you tell the story, Bob?
Well, I'll tell it.
Well, that's true. Well, well, yeah. Everybody sitting up here can tell you, the drummer, the great Earl Palmer, was nobody coming behind him. So Earl said, well, I might take off, one of those type of things. And I said, okay, Bob, yeah, and he went on vacation. Thank you.
Nothing but the California.
I like to tell a story about Dave. Years ago, when I first got into recording business, they didn't have the that expressway that they have now on Claiborne Avenue. I guess that's the expressway, whatever it is. Yeah, right now, man. Well, that's what it is now, I guess. But they haven't started building that, you know. So we always had a place across from where he had his office to go get some oyster loaves and raw oysters and things like that. So one day I came at the studio, at the office. I'm sitting down, the Dave came later. And I was eating some dietitian cookies. I was about 260 pounds at that time. And Dave kind of said, man, what is that you're eating? And I said, man, that's some dietitian. I've just got to lose some weight, man. He said, oh, okay. So he go in the back, he get a magazine. He say, hey, Wardell, look at this, man. And there is a magazine with duck. There's roast. There's some pig meat and all that kind of stuff, all steaming up in there. And I said, Dave, man, don't do that to me, man. So he said, don't do what, man? I said, don't be showing me that, man. I said, okay. So he said, oh, what the hell, I'll be back. So he went across the street to the oyster place and got an oyster loaf. And he came back. And I'm trying to write some music or concentrate on something. And Dave said, hey, man, look at this, man. And there's that oyster loaf, fresh as can be, smelling as can be. And there goes my cookies. Yeah. I'll never forget that, man. Dave was a cruel dude. Thanks, Dave.
I got one more to tell you about what else.
Hold on.
No, we're not. But you got to hear this one. So he hadn't played piano in a long time. The late Edward Frank. I said, I got a European too. He said, I need some money. I said, well, you're the next piano player. He said, no, I'm not. So sure enough, I said, oh, come on, what else? So we're going to Paris. We stay in Paris 2 weeks. We come back to New Orleans, go back to Rivera. When we're back in Rivera, we're up in the mountains. I mean, way up in the mountains. We don't have no rest. We're just real tired. So when we get up there, young guy interested in the piano player, watching Wardell. said, hey, mister, come over here. This man's sleeping on a piano. Whatever, sleeping on a piano. He said, y'all supposed to be playing. I said, well, that's okay. Just let him make this money. Good night. Thank you, everybody.
That was the second time in my life I seen you as a cruel man. Because one of the first songs we pulled out was Stardust. And I remember telling you something, man, I'm not a piano player. I'm not what you call a tinkler. I can sit down there and I can play the chords, but I can't doodle. So if you say doodle, I walk away from you. So he is, man, and said, what else? Give me an introduction. I said, blink, 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 blink. So he comes in with the thing, man, and heaven only knows I couldn't play the chords at all. That's the first time I played Stardust in such a cruel key. And make these piano players that's coming out now with that weird music sound crazy. But I never forgave you that from either. Way in France at that. But they were used to that kind of music anyway. Had good times with you there. It's real nice.
Thank you.
Bob, you want to talk a little bit about how you how you started your sessions?
I got my shotgun.
That's true.
And I threatened him. No, actually, I like to say this. This is a pleasure to be here. I had forgotten, and I got a phone call this morning. I said, who is this, Samuel? And it was Ira. I said, are you coming? Coming where, Ira? I thought it was at night. Then I called Dave, and he said, well, it's this morning? I said, yeah, I'll be down and get you. I dressed, I called my son, got our personal chauffeur, called my son, he picked me up. We went and got Dave, and we're here. But I have to say this. You have to give due where it's due. This man sitting on the end, the one sitting right here, and the one sitting here. This is New Orleans. They're New Orleans. As far as when you talk about music, you got to talk about one of the three or all three of them, okay? Because he has done so many things. Written so many good songs. I'm talking about Mr. Batiste. I'm going to call y'all Mr. Batiste because all y'all older than me. I have a band. Everybody in my band is young. They call me old folks. You know, they call me old folks. I say, just keep living. Maybe you get to be old one day. Yeah. But anyway, I respect my elders because I came up in a family with a daddy. I had a daddy and a mother. And coincidentally, my mother and this man is related, so automatically that makes us
the biggest city in Louisiana.
Relative, right.
Edgard, Louisiana.
But if you're riding through, if you blink your eyes, you missed it. Yeah. Sitting right by the levee. But anyway, I was always around music from the time I was born. My daddy was a banjo player, guitar player. And I've always heard music. I was hearing music when I was in my mother's stomach. And when I got to be about 14 years old, I got interested in playing music. My daddy, being a musician, he knew better than me. I wanted to play drums. He said, nah, you don't want to play drums. He said, you'll be the first one on a gig and the last one to leave with all that stuff. So he said, I got a better idea. Let's go to Worldlines and get you a trumpet. Now, this is in the 50s, Wardell. Now, he was a trumpet player, too. So is Dave. He bought me a King trumpet player in the 50s, like 1951, like my freshman year at St. Augustine. And my daddy paid like $300 and a couple of dollars for this horn. $300 in the 50s was a lot of money. And I was telling him, you don't have to spend all this money. He said, well, if you're going to play on something good. It makes it easy for you. I said, but I don't want to play. I want to play drums. But back in them days, you have to listen to that mom and daddy, okay? So I got the trumpet, start taking trumpet lessons from Houston Music School, Houston itself, okay? And I was all right, and I played a little bit, and I played around. And the more I played it, the more I hated it, okay? You got to like it to do it. So I finally talked my daddy into getting a set of drums for me. And we went to Rampart Street. Rampart Street is that-a-way. And 100 block of Rampart Street, there were pawn shops. And one of the world's greatest drummers, besides Earl Palmer, was Louis Barbaran. You heard of Paul Barbaran, who wrote the Bourbon Street Parade and all those other things. His brother. As far as playing traditional music, nobody could touch him. Nobody. And if they tell you somebody is better than them, tell them Bob Frank said they're a liar. Because this man could play. And I sat under him many a nights because at 15 years old, my daddy had the band. He played with Celestine Band just like he did. And when Celestine died, the trombone player took over the band. What was his name? I talked about the band all day yesterday. I'll tell you his name. Eddie Pearson. Eddie Pearson lived 2 years. He died. My dad took over the band. And they had this old school bus. And this school bus is in La Place, on a property in La Place, and it's sitting down with grass growing around it. I'm going around and knock the grass around and take some pictures of it because it was part of the history of the band. And I would drive the bus. They'd go 100, 200 miles. Everybody in the band go to sleep. I'm driving, 15 years old. I got a license. I'm legal. But I'm around these people, and I'm absorbing some of that knowledge. If you want to learn something, listen at somebody that's older than you that has some knowledge. Don't listen to a fool. There are a lot of fools out there. But you listen at somebody that knows what they're doing. And I was around these people, and they really taught me some things. Mr. Barbaran, make a long story short, Mr. Barbaran, we went to drums, to a pawn shop. And I bought a whole set of drums for $110. And I kept that set of drums for years. He would not teach me. He refused to teach me. I said, I want you to teach me. Didn't teach me. And till this day, I'm sorry, because he could have taught me something about traditional music that nobody else could have taught me. But I learned how to play a little bit, and I can still play a little bit. But that was the beginning of my venture into music. So I started playing, practicing. The first band I started with, Art Neville was in the band. Charles Neville was in the band. A man by the name of James Booker was in the band. It was J.C. Goods, y'all don't know anything about it. His daddy had more money than any black man in this city. He had a moving company. And we used to go to his house and rehearse every day. He had three pianos in the living room. And his mother-in-law lived there, and she would feed us, seven of us, every day. And that was a pleasure. We'd leave school, go rehearse. Got the band together. It was the Turquoise. Stayed together a while. First one to leave was Charles Neville. He left, went with a band in Florida. All of them older than him, you know. That's where he learned all his bad habits from, okay? And then Art Neville left and went with the Hawkettes. And the year he left, they recorded the Mardi Gras Mambo, which is still played every Mardi Gras, okay? And then J.C., he stayed and he played with some people. And my first band that I played with, that besides that band that was worth anything, was James Sugarboy Crawford, who Dave knew. He didn't record for you, did he, Dave? He recorded for you. Okay. Well, he had a big hit. He had a couple of big hits. And I started playing and making money, and I was making $8 a night. That was big money. $8. You know, you could buy a gallon of gas for 25 cents back in the days. And so that was my first experience. So after I got so I could play a little bit, I saw Wardell. Mystic was there when I was in high school, because the band that he played with, the Raw Dukes of Rhythm, they used to play for all our functions at St. Augustine. Okay? And Mr. Baptiste, he was always at the Dewdrop or somewhere playing and playing with the bebop bands. He played everything. He played bebop, R&B, blues, you know. And this is what you have to do in New Orleans. You have to learn how to play everything. He did the same thing. Dave did the same thing. But I played this music, and I was lucky to play with Sugar Boy. And I played with Frogman Henry. I sang like a frog. Yeah, made a lot of money right down the street on Bourbon Street. And so when I got into the music, he lived like three doors from me on Robert Street. So I go down to his house, family, so we can talk. I said, man, when are you going to give me a session? You know, I jacked him up in his house. I said, you got to give me a session. He said, well, I got Earl Palmer, you know. So you got to wait your turn. I said, maybe but you can give me a session, you know, because I want to do this. No way in the world I was in the category with Earl Palmer. Earl Palmer was one of the greatest drummers that ever picked up two drumsticks. So I kept on. And one day, before that, he hired me to do one or two sessions with Earl King and somebody else. Well, that was it, you know. And I was home one afternoon. I was still at home. I was living with mom and daddy. Easy to live there. They feed you and put a roof over your head. So the phone rang. It was a Saturday. I'll never forget this. And it was Dave. He said, what you doing? I said, nothing. I was just looking at some sports on TV. He said, bring your stuff down to the studio. At that time, you had to bring your own equipment. Bring your stuff to the studio. Antoine Drummer didn't show up. Tanu was the drummer. Cornelius, what is his name? Cornelius what? You remember his last name? Huh? Cornelius Coleman. But it was Tanu. See, Tanu didn't show up. Come on down. I had on a pair of Bermuda shorts in them days. I would, out of the Bermuda shorts, would put some real clothes on and down at Cosmo Studio on Rampart Street in 20 minutes. You're going to recall with Fats Domino. I was running over the red lights and everything else. Fats Domino was the biggest thing in the country. So I go in. This is where Cosmo comes into play. And I love this man to this day because as many times as I recorded, he was always the same. He had that smile on his face, always talked to you like you were a man. Even when I wasn't a man, he did. And we go in and we record. So we did the band was rehearsing. So I set up the drums. They said, well, we're going to run through, and then we're going to take. They did a take. And Kaz came out the studio. Wait, he said, look, I know what you're doing, but you're going to have to play louder. Turn your drumsticks around. You got to bang. We got one microphone in the whole room has to pick up all the instruments. It wasn't like it is today. Huh? One microphone. The man was a miracle man. Is a miracle man. Still alive and with us. Thank God. So we do the thing. And we play it. And after we played it, he did this to me. He said, all right, it was loud enough. So he played it back. Dave was in the studio with inside the booth,
trying to get a balance
with Kaz. Okay, so we did the first one, and after we did it, he played it back, and so he says, Antoine, turn the fast. What do you think about it? Yeah. Take another one. So okay, we took another one. Oh no, take another one. We're up to 15 then. Take another.
Sometimes in the studio at that time we had to move the drums, small room, different places, and it waked the hell out of him. Not only him, any drummer that came there, because we didn't have all the things that you have now. You just push a button if you want more drums. Well, those days were rough. Going to the studio 8 in the morning, 8 at night, you're still there. My first one, I say, ain't nobody in the world being in no studio all day long. So she and the bass player wife, Camp Frank Fields. This is really true. They got there one day about 12 o'clock. And we had been there since 8 o'clock. 10 o'clock that night, they said, hell with you guys. You know, I said, hey, nobody does anything like this. But right now, you just push a button and it's all over with. But we had to do this to try to get a balance. Sometimes they're talking. I said, well, please don't talk. because we don't have but one or two mics, and that's what's happening. We're trying to get a balance. Oh, I don't know what you're talking about. That's what my drummer said. I mean, my guitar player, God bless the dead. I said,
Justin.
I said, Justin, please. And he was my regular guitar player. He kept on. I said, look, man, we've been here 4 or 5 hours. Take the rest of the year off. And he said, oh, that man. This is true. I didn't mean that in the sense that it was said, but he was messing with progress. But he stayed there for he was back for the last 25 years. But man, thing when in the studio, it's a business like anything else. And right now, you don't have no problem. Just push a button, it's all over with. Back to power.
So after we got it all straight, played another one, played it for Antoine. Dave loved it. And let's take another one, Brother Holloman. So after we got up to take 22, I remember this like it was yesterday. After we got to take 22, I don't care because we're making money. See, longer we stay, the more money we make. So we got to 22. He played it for him. It wasn't anything wrong with it. So he said, but downhill, play take two. Went back and played it. You remember? Take two. Played it, the old one, played it, and after he played it, he said, that's it, that's the one I want. I don't remember the song, but I know one thing. I played it in my sleep for a couple of nights. But the beauty of working with Cosmo and working with him, he knew what he was doing. Cos knew what he was doing. They never had an argument. They never had a disagreement, okay, those two. Now, he and Antoine, that's another thing. You want me to leave it on? No, I'm going to expose y'all. I could tell him a little bit, huh? Dave knows what he's doing, right? Antoine, heck of a musician, heck of a singer, but he likes to have his way. So Clarence Ford, heck of a saxophone player, he's dead. I knew Clarence. They got into an argument in the studio, and I was getting out the way. I was going to fisticuffs, you know? So Clarence tapped me on the knee and said, don't worry about it, Bob. They love each other. They ain't going to fight. So they got into a thing. And so Dave said, okay, we're going to do it your way. So they did it. It wasn't right. So they wound up doing it Dave's way. And it was all right. But I wound up staying in the studio one day for 12 hours. The greatest thing about staying in there for 12 hours is after you pass 3 hours, you started getting overtime. So by me being 18, 19 years old, I could have stayed in there for 24 hours. It wouldn't have made any difference. You know, give me something to eat. They sent out to get something to eat. We eat, get a little taste, going back again. And my first check from Fast Domino, that was about the third or fourth. The first check was, what was it, 35? What was the recording session? About $35, right?
Yeah.
Right. So went, huh? $41.25. All right, I'm close enough. It's amazing how he's 89 years old. He can remember those things.
That was a lot of money. That was the union.
That was union scale.
In all my sessions, 496, that was our union at that time. We're 174 right now, but we are now integrated. So at that time, the union man always had to sit. Mr. Baptiste, you remember that?
Yeah.
The union man would sit there doing the whole session. All he's doing is time, Mr. John. I don't know if you remember Mr. John. Man, make about three like me. He'd sit there, and all he's doing is timing you. That means that whatever it is, when the session is over, they'll get the fellas on the side and say, well, okay, you got 5 or 6 hours overtime, whatever, that kind of thing. Which was nice, because we used to work the people to death in a place like that to get a sound. But right now, but Bob is saying is true. By playing a drum, I like to kill them. Because sometimes we have to move the drums from one corner to the other, and that type of said, oh, Lord, what is this, man, you know? But but it all paid off.
I didn't mind, Dave. I didn't mind. I was working. I was playing with Fats Domino and Dave Thalman. But when I went down to get the, you had to wait a week to get your check. And I went to the union that was on Claiborne Street, and the woman gave me the check. And when I got the check, my hands started shaking. It was over $500. It went from 30 some odd dollars to that overtime to $500. I said, I know I'm in the right business. So I started begging him again, when are you going to give me some of them other sessions? Couldn't play none because Earl was there, right? So anyway, Earl got to be worldwide known. And went to California. I was saluting him goodbye. So I said, well, now Earl is gone to California. What about the job now? Do I get the job now? He said, yeah, you got the job. Because I used to always tell him, you remember that what I used to always say? I said, you know, Dave, it's a shame. You have a recording session. It's always the same people. Click. You got the click. You're in the click. Always with the click. Ain't gonna give, don't give the youngsters a chance. The only thing I was doing was a couple of things, you know. Yeah, it's always the clicks. I had a band, and he recorded my whole band with one of the guys singing. I said, I'm tired of that click thing. So when Earl left and went to California, he called me and said, I got some gigs for you. So we played the first time, session. And after we got through the session, he said, how you like the click now?
That is really the truth.
That's the truth. I ain't lying. I said, I love the click because I'm in the click now.
Well, we wanted to thank our participants, Harold Batiste, Wardell Cazare, Bob French, Mandy started it all, Dave Bartholomew. And Dave also wanted me to let you know that another person who's not here today that played a large role was Alan Toussaint. Because without these people, New Orleans music as we know it, and probably the influence of American rock and roll on the world over the last 60 to 70 years wouldn't have existed without these gentlemen. Oh, yes. Harold's got his new book out that just came out. It's a very good read.
Ladies and gents, I was just telling Dr. Ira, we forgot the young man is instrumental in being one of the guys that actually built New Orleans too, Mr. Alan Toussaint. Great piano player, beautiful, just a beautiful guy. Nobody in the world got more manners than him. He's always such a gentleman. I just didn't want to leave him out. There are two or three others, but you know, I'm not too close to them, so I wouldn't be able to say anything. But all these people up here and Mr. Alan Toussaint, some people that actually built New Orleans. Thank you.
He was a part of your band, you remember?
That's right.
Thank you very, very much, gentlemen. This is going to be a session that we're going to remember for many years, I'm sure. We're going to take a very short break now. Obviously, we've gone into our break time, but well worth it, to set up the next session in about 5 minutes. Thank you.